thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 85, recorded April 26th, 2012. Book 'em, Bezos. Welcome, everyone, to another edition of Digital Campus here on a very wet and rainy morning in Fairfax, Virginia, which is not a bad thing considering that it's been dry and dusty here for quite a while. So we're kind of excited about rain, which says something about the kind of sad state of our lives that we get excited about rain these days. But we're joined on the podcast, as always, by our regulars, Amanda French from AmandaFrench.net. Amanda, how are you this morning?
I'm doing very well, Mills. I've just returned from Philadelphia, where I spent a lovely day yesterday at That Camp Penn, and I had a great time.
Good. How many people were there?
They had roughly 80 people registered, and I think most of them showed up, so, you know, 70-ish.
That's nice. That's nice. Based on my experiences there, I bet you had a lot of grad students.
We did, yeah. I think a lot of grad students, a lot of librarians, people working at libraries and archives in the Philadelphia area, but definitely some Penn faculty, too, which was great.
Very nice. Very nice. And Tom Scheinfeld. Tom, are you still up there in Connecticut?
Yep, up here in Connecticut on a frosty morning. Yep.
Yeah, the weather's been strange.
It's been strange.
It was 89 degrees here last Monday and 39 degrees this Monday, so go figure. And Tom, of course, can be found at foundhistory.org. Dan Cohen, our colleague over in a building across campus from me. Dan, are you across campus from me today?
I am. I am in my cave.
Yes, in your bat cave.
Battling evil.
Yes, yeah. I am, with multiple mice and screens here.
Well, very
I'm taking,
nice.
Taking the easy way of battling evil.
With Twitter, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard about that thing.
Tweet the evil away is what I say.
Yeah, let me know how that works for you.
Okay.
So, and Dan, of course, can be found at dancohen.org. I didn't even introduce myself. I'm Mills Kelly from edwired.org in a separate building here at George Mason. And then finally, we're really excited to have Tim Carmody from regular contributor to Wired Magazine here joining us today. Tim, how are you?
I'm doing just fine.
And where are you?
I'm in New York City.
New York City. Okay, so your weather is probably the same as ours. So now that everybody has the East Coast weather forecast down, and at least for the day that we're recording this, I want to go back to everyone cast their minds back to a story that we brought up at the previous podcast, in which the four of us regulars pretended like we actually knew what we were talking about, which was the trouble that the Apple Corporation has found itself in with our friends at the Department of Justice across the river. And this is why we asked Tim to be on the podcast this morning, because Tim actually knows a lot about this subject, having written for it for Wired. So, Tim, can you give us sort of a status update on what's going on with this, what the key issues are, and why we should care?
Sure. Well, I'm not sure where you left it on the last podcast, so maybe we'll just, you know, do a recap. Department of Justice opened an investigation and actually filed a civil lawsuit against Apple and five of the big six trade publishers. So everybody except Random House. So that's Macmillan, Penguin, Hachette. This is where I always start to lose my cognitive recall to remember all of the big six. Basically, everyone except Random House. So it's the five of the big six who originally teamed up with Apple at the launch of iBooks back in 2010. And the issue is the simultaneous move of all these publishers to an agency rather than a wholesale pricing model. and potential evidence of collusion among them, that they conspired to do this in order to break the rising power of Amazon and to prop up ebook prices in order to so that ebook prices did not corrode hardcover and paperback prices, and also so that Amazon didn't get genuine monopoly power over the ebook market. So that's the issue. And what they have, what the Department of Justice has, is a number of communications between the publishers and so this is private communications and mostly that appear very bad. So this is so the issue is not just the business model that that the publishers decided to all simultaneously switch to. The issue is not just the fact that this raised ebook prices, although that's why the Department of Justice is interested, but it's the fact that they all got to they didn't all meet in a single room, but that they coordinated their actions among each other. And that's where the that's where antitrust concerns begin to kick in. So where it stands now, so three of the five publishers, and so that is at a certain point we need to get better terms for this. So we have the big six. We sort of need like the colluding five and the settling three. So Hachette, HarperCollins, and Simon & Schuster are the three publishers who've already agreed to settle with the U.S. Department of Justice. And this, there's also similar cases being filed in state courts, and there's also a class action lawsuit that are very similar, but the DOJ investigation and the settlement are separate from that. So Apple, Penguin, and Macmillan are the ones who are who have resolved to fight the this lawsuit. And what the terms of the proposed settlement do is basically they force all of the publishers involved to renegotiate new contracts. It permits the agency model, but it really limits the ability. What the agency model did, why the agency model was interesting, agency model itself is just sort of a consignment shop idea where it's, you know, I haven't sold this thing to you, you're acting as my agent. And but what agency model did that made it really appealing for the publishers was that it allowed them to set the prices of books in the ebook stores. So what Amazon was doing was buying the ebooks and then sharply discounting them, selling them at a loss or at very, very thin margins to help drum up the ebook business back in those days of, you know, 2008-2009 when the ebook business was really just trying to get off the ground. And so what the proposed settlement does is it basically compels the settling publishers to allow retailers, even if they're using the agency model, to continue to offer discounts on ebooks. So it really limits their ability to set prices, and in particular to hold prices constant across stores. Some of these things are a little bit funny. I'm not exactly sure why the Department of Justice sees like a compelling antitrust interest in preserving the possibility that a retailer can offer a buy one, get one free model for ebooks. Like, that's kind of a cool promotion, but it's not really, I don't see exactly why the law has to get involved there to make sure that Amazon has that right to introduce that particular innovation in ebooks. So essentially, that's sort of where it stands from the lawsuit perspective. There have been different public statements that have been issued by Apple, by Penguin, by Macmillan, you know, they're set to fight this out, and it's not totally clear one question that people might be interested in is, you know, why are some people settling and some people not? There's some speculation that suggests that remember, all of these companies, they're big companies in themselves. They're, you know, we call the big six for a reason. They publish huge number, especially of the very popular books. So that's what, you know, we call them trade publishers. So different from academic publishers or specialty publishers.
Yeah, the Nora Roberts of the world.
Exactly. Or, you know, everything that you've ever seen on the New York Times bestseller list is published by one of these big six, just about. And also, in turn, all of them are owned by gigantic corporations. So, you know, Penguin is owned by Pearson. Simon & Schuster is owned by CBS. Random House is not involved, but, you know, Random House is owned by News Corp. Hachette is, you know, a giant global publishing corporation. There's Macmillan is owned by Holtzbrinck, you know, which is another international corporation. So these, you know, these corporations have, you know, big interests that go well beyond, you know, publishing popular, popular paperback books. So in some cases, they've made the decision that, you know, they're just not interested in, you know, in fighting out this lawsuit. And, you know, it's also potentially the case that that the DOJ may have a stronger case against some of these publishers than others, again, based on the nature of the communications that they've been able to find. So, you know, and including, you know, some of the juicy tidbits dropped in the filing are, you know, instructions from high-ranking publishing executives to, you know, double delete secret communications, which whatever, you know, and so it's like, there, it's, you know, it's like, you know, double delete this email, and that's the email that they have. Like, so, you know, they clearly knew, some of them at least clearly knew that they were up to no good, and tried to cover their tracks. And so in that case, where you really have a smoking gun against some of these publishers, you know, again, it's just like, you know, just like, you know, imagine Law and Order. It's like, you know, you've got, you know, got me dead to rights. It's like, I'm going to do whatever I can to try to mitigate this damage. I'm not saying that that's true for all of the publishers who settled, but it's certainly a consideration that each of them are weighing, is what is the relative evidence that you have for collusion. And in particular, the case against Apple is...
Right, that's what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
Why are they still... I mean, what is Apple's interest? I mean, I see from the publishers they want to set their prices. What is Apple's interest in both in, you know, in this alleged collusion and in continuing to fight this rather than settling themselves?
Right. There's sort of two issues in terms of, like, you know, why did Apple get involved with this this ebook thing in the first place? And one is the idea that Apple sort of cares very deeply about this, or two theories, I should say. One is that Apple cares very deeply about this. Apple saw Amazon as a rising competitor in sales of media. Apple wanted to get a hold of the ebook market. It saw that as an emerging thing, and it figured out a way to do that and secure itself a certain amount of market share and at the same time stop a rising competitor. That's the sort of more sinister theory about why Apple got involved with this and was able to, and in particular, you know, negotiated contracts that are identical to its App Store contracts, which is you set the price, we take 30%, and you don't sell it at a different price anyplace else. And that turned out to be, you know, a very handy bludgeon against Amazon and some of the other ebook retailers. The other is that Apple never really cared about ebooks at all. This is actually kind of a pet theory of mine, is that Apple sort of knew that it had to introduce something when it introduced the iPad with respect to reading. It didn't have, at that time, you know, there weren't iPad e-reading apps ready to go. But at the same time, it had no interest in dealing with the really complicated world of book pricing. And so the easy, you know, music is easy, 99 cents a track. Movies, TV shows, pretty easy. You know, they can set those prices and they're pretty uniform. Books are all over the place. Books are a pain. Books are a bad margin business. So what Apple did really was it took a model, very successful model from its App Store, that guaranteed it the minimal amount of pain. You know, again, it's like it made 30% on every sale, whether it was good or bad. And they didn't have to worry about trying to figure out what an ebook should cost. It put all of that onus on the publisher. And they knew, Apple also knew, that they were going to have a very hot product with the iPad. Not everybody was convinced, but I think Apple was really convinced that this was something that it was a good product and that they were in a position to negotiate what actually were very favorable terms to Apple. Apple made much better money from a margin perspective than Amazon or any other ebook retailer were making. So those are the kind of, you know, the sort of secret scheming Apple and the, we don't care, we're going to make our margins no matter what, climb aboard if you want to get on this train, Apple. So that's how they got involved with it in the first place. The reason why they're fighting it, sorry, go ahead.
No, could you just clarify one thing? I've seen in the reactions that people are saying, well, Apple in this lawsuit seems to be in a very good spot because they can just claim they're doing the same 30% cut on sort of all their items. But isn't it true that the music they actually do buy wholesale and then just resell it for 99 cents or 129?
Music, movies, and TV they buy wholesale.
Yeah.
Essentially every, all the other media that they sell, they buy wholesale. They set the price. And occasionally get into kind of fraught negotiations with the movie studios or the TV studios. You might remember this is years back, but NBC at one point, pulled all its TV shows off of iTunes because it wanted a better wholesale price. So it's not the case that they do this with everything. That's sort of been the idea. It's like, oh, this is just Apple's standard business model. No, in the case of media, it isn't. But at the same time, it's a model that with the introduction of the App Store after the iPhone seemed to work very well, and that, again, you could argue because of this huge variability in pricing in the book market was more appropriate for books than those wholesale models for media. But Apple absolutely could have entered in and worked out a wholesale book model. That wasn't the model that they chose to go with. And they had every reason to believe that publishers would find this to be an attractive model, because they knew exactly that publishers were very worried about maintaining price parity between ebooks and print books, and they were worried about Amazon.
And so if I'm the consumer, then I care about this because Apple, in this, assuming that they were colluding for the moment, that with the publishers, they were artificially holding the line on price, or through collusion, holding the line on prices and keeping those prices up. So it was costing me more money, which for something that Amazon would have been willing to sell me at a discount. And that's what I couldn't do. And so I should actually, as a consumer, I should be happy, right?
Maybe. I don't know. It's definitely the case that ebook prices went up. Whether ebook prices went up through legal or illegal means, that's the sort of question. But that's why the Department of Justice is interested, is because, and that's sort of restricting their view. So, other people have said, well, what about Amazon? Amazon's got monopoly power. Amazon has tried to do predatory pricing, which is also something that's illegal under, where you basically price something, well below cost or something to try to force other competitors out of business. Amazon is, trying to ratchet down what it pays for wholesale prices to everybody who's still on the wholesale model. What about Amazon? Why isn't the Department of Justice investigating them? And essentially what the Department of Justice has said in its lawsuit is it said, well, whatever Amazon was doing, it didn't raise ebook prices for consumers. And so their monopsony power, their ability as a sort of dominant buyer of books from these publishers really hasn't entered into it, because the DOJ has essentially taken the stance that Amazon ultimately what they were doing was good for consumers because it was driving down prices and building all of these things in. There are a lot of things, arguing the other side, there are a lot of things that the agency model did that were very good for ebook consumers. So it did allow for a wider range of retail stores to spring up, and for different ebook players to to get a foothold in the market, from Barnes & Noble to Kobo to Apple's iBooks. And what it did is, because these retailers were no longer competing against price, they began to compete on services. They began to, you know, Amazon itself started to offer, you know, cloud backup, not just for the stuff that Amazon was offering in its own store, but for any document. They offered sync. They offered social media integration. They offered, you know, just a really, they started building apps out for phones and tablets and desktop. So they started doing multimedia books as a way to get people's attention and sort of leverage the unique possibilities on different platforms. So where you could have seen ebooks before as a kind of race to the bottom, as sort of, you know, we're going to just sell everything, we're just going to sell the text as cheaply as possible. One of the things that agency did, arguably, was make ebooks themselves and e-readers better. And that because they had to compete along different terms. There are other things that get into it for consumers, but I think some of it is going to be, you know, what kinds of pricing are you going to be starting to see from these different ebook stores? The weird thing about it from a consumer choice perspective is that ebooks are not a really variable market in terms of, it's like, well, I've got an e-reader, I'm going to go around to all the different stores and shop for the best price. Well, that doesn't really work because the e-reader you have is tied to a store. You're essentially a captive customer of Amazon or Barnes & Noble or whatever your favorite, even if you're on an iPad or something like that, whatever your favorite e-reading app is. There's no a single app that is, you know, going to integrate all these books from all the different stores. So it's not like we can really shop around for the best prices. But what we may start to see, either as the settlement is implemented or as the case is decided, is some attempts to try to do that, to try to entice customers in based on the price of the books.
Go ahead, Amanda.
Yep. I've seen speculation recently that in the wake of this lawsuit, the big six publishers may begin dropping DRM.
Yeah, so that's going to bring up.
Yeah,
and so there's already a trial balloon in the works. So Tor, which is a science fiction imprint of Macmillan, who's, you know, one of the publishers. Macmillan has always been the sort of avant-garde of the big six. Macmillan was the first publisher to insist on agency pricing and really sort of force Amazon to adopt that model by saying they would withdraw all their books. Tor's their science fiction imprint, and, you know, publishes people like Cory Doctorow, you know, sort of famous, you know, anti-DRM, kind of anti-copyright activists. And what they've already done is said, we're dropping DRM from our ebooks. And so this has been seen as a kind of trial balloon for what the big six may do. And essentially, I call it the nuclear option. It's really the only arrow they have left in their quiver against Amazon, which still controls a gigantic share of the ebook market. So the only way that they can really combat Amazon, if Amazon's willing to sell ebooks at a loss or sell ebooks at super razor thin margins and doesn't care how much money they make as long as they get share, is for and they've got, you know, a huge chunk of the e-reader, you know, people with Amazon e-readers. The only way they have around that for people to reach those customers, those captive Amazon customers, is for the publishers to offer books DRM free, so that customers can actually buy books from any retailer and read them on any device.
By the way, as a card carrying member of the Acronym Expansion Association, I'm going to stipulate that DRM stands for Digital Rights Management.
Yes.
I'm sure we all know that, and most of our listeners do, but just to make it clear that that's the technology that makes it difficult, though not impossible, to move an ebook from your Kindle to your Nook or Kobo or iBook.
Yes. So, DRM is fairly easily circumvented. It requires a little bit more sophistication than ripping a CD or even converting or even ripping a DVD, but not much more.
And I believe it's not technically illegal. Is that correct? The way it is with DVDs.
I had thought it was the opposite. Actually,
I thought so. I thought so too. I thought that the DMCA was kind of agnostic on the media type, but that breaking DRM was illegal under copyright.
I thought it was specified in the DMCA that that DVDs were specified in the DMCA, and that's why it's illegal to break DRM on DVDs, but isn't on CDs. I'm not sure.
CDs actually predate the DMCA,
right.
and didn't have DRM. So CDs you can rip freely. But ebooks, breaking DRM on ebooks, I believe is illegal. I am not 100% sure on that. I know I recently read an article about that suggested that was basically said, hey, DOJ, it's like if you're really interested in, I think it was Tim Lee, he writes for a couple places, writes for Ars Technica, writes at Forbes, terrific, tech policy author, but said, hey, if the federal government's really interested in the ebook market, they ought to look at the fact that they've made breaking DRM illegal, actually criminally illegal.
So it sounds to me then that what, given this lawsuit, we should expect probably that Amazon will reclaim its position or its ability to start pushing prices down again. But isn't the fear that then at some point they will have gained enough market share, enough of the sort of control of this this piece of the market, that then they'll be in a position to raise prices however they feel they want?
Either raise prices however they feel they want or lower what they pay. What's more likely, what we've seen more often, is lower the share that they pay to publishers, that they'll basically cut their suppliers down.
So the Walmart strategy, in other words.
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think Tim had a good article, which I was sort of humming the John Williams Empire Strikes Back, theme in my head about Jeff. Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
Sorry.
Just about Jeff Bezos. And I think, the main thing is, the book publishers care about books. I think Bezos is, hunting bigger game. And, I think his overall strategy, I really doubt that he's, going to lower ebook prices to then triple them in 5 years when there's nothing but the Kindle. He wants to get people to buy into Amazon Prime and, streaming video and get all these goodies and buy everything possible from Amazon. So he just wants to make a comfy home where we buy everything from. And I think books are just one piece of that. Is that right, Tim? I mean,
yeah,
he's got a bigger strategy.
True. Amazon wants to be your universal retailer. It wants to be, again, it's not just the Walmart strategy. It's Walmart made perfect.
Right.
It's Walmart made virtual. It's Walmart made totally universal. It's Walmart with free 2-day delivery to your home. And for Amazon, this is true. You see this actually at Walmart. Books are a loss leader. If you want, there was a huge outcry at the independent booksellers a few months back. People were selling things like, Sarah Palin's autobiography or whatever her book was, below cost. And the idea is, you get in the door to buy a book and maybe at a Walmart, and you buy your groceries, you buy tube socks, and maybe you also buy a big screen television. And it's more valuable to Amazon that they are seen as a retailer for everything. At the same time, books are the force where they're dominant, both in ebooks and in printed books, at least printed books purchased online. It's a terrific business for them. It's also one where you have to think about this at the level of law, and you have to think about this at the level of PR. At the level of PR, Apple, whatever it cares or doesn't care about books, Apple doesn't want to be seen as being someone who got together with a nefarious New York cabal to, I'm just speaking again in terms of what the potential perception is. I don't think publishers are really a nefarious New York cabal. Living in New York and being good friends with people in the publishing industry, I think I'm actually legally obligated. I think maybe I signed like a non-disclosure or non-disparagement agreement to not speak ill of New York City publishers. But they don't want to be seen as someone who got together in order to screw over consumers. And same thing as Amazon loves being seen as being the digital disruptor, the innovator who wanted to bring all of these goodies at low, low prices to consumers. And it's these bad established businesses who got in the way. So they're, you know, they're fighting it at many fronts. And so when you see different things happening, when you see public statements happening, sometimes even news stories that are seeded by people from these different companies, remember, there's a legal battle that's being set up here, and there's also sort of an ideological battle for perception.
I have to say, too, I keep imagining that, say, a few years down the road, say 2014, 2015, 2016, I feel like it's almost inevitable from a narrative point of view that the DOJ will bring some kind of lawsuit against Amazon. You know, I feel like it's just sort of, you know, in the story that will unfold that eventually Amazon will trip over its own feet in terms of some kind of monopoly on this kind of thing. But that's just my narrative.
I think that's quite a possibility. I mean, and again, you know, there's also, again, you know, sort of the Justice Department. The Justice Department saw kind of classic collusion happening here. I mean, again, emails between people conspiring together to raise prices. That's sort of, you know, the DOJ's bread and butter. What Amazon is doing is a little weirder. It's something that's new. It's something that, you know, you sort of have to kind of, it takes a while to wrap your head around. And I think certainly to the extent that they abuse whatever pricing power that they have disproportionately, and especially I think as that, you know, there's sort of a consumer focus right now at the DOJ for a lot of different reasons, or political reasons involved too. You know, I think you'll see increased scrutiny. And this will also be, you know, sort of a test to see, you know, how well the Department of Justice can deal with these new technologies. There's been a lot of different things suggesting that they are increasingly, that the wheels of government are turning to the world of digital. Yeah. And they're looking for hijinks and trying to figure out what they can do to both prevent both egregious bad actions and kind of bad structures from emerging.
Tie this to academia, I'm sorry, Mel.
Oh, go ahead.
I mean, you know, moving from the Big Six to university presses and others who publish books for, you know, what is obviously a much more limited market, where book prices tend to be a lot higher, often, you know, $50 to $100 for a monograph. I think there's a lot of academics who have looked to Amazon who've actually discounted these books that you often can't get discounted. I'm pretty sure that most university presses are not working on the agency model with anyone. I think they're selling a $50 book to Amazon at $30 or whatever their standard, or $25. And, you know, in one sense, you know, and I've kind of debated people on this a bit. I'd like to know more about the elasticity of demand on academic books at different price points. I don't think we've had a good enough debate about that. And I get a lot of, you know, sort of flame online when I bring this up. But I think it's an interesting thing when Amazon lowers a $50 book to $25, an academic book, to see. And I've seen it with one of the books I have written, where I have sold a lot of Kindle editions when they've lowered it from, I mean, what's crazy is the Kindle edition, which costs nothing to produce, it's an electronic file, costs $50, and the print edition is $50. But sometimes Amazon will discount it to 40 or 30, and sales definitely go up. So there is some elasticity of demand, especially with the general public. And I just think in a digital age, university presses are going to have to become a little bit more flexible on pricing, and to see what might happen. I mean, maybe it's not a doubling in sales, but I'm not convinced that a $100 monograph needs to be $100, even to maximize profits. You know.
Well, this is something that's really interesting. So, I did a long interview with the CEO of Smashwords, Mark Coker, and he has an argument. So, Smashwords is one of iBooks' initial partners. They're a self-publishing aggregator, and what they do is they allow the authors to set prices. And what they found is that authors are way more interested in experimenting with pricing than publishers are. And in particular, because authors, for the most part, want to be read, and they're perfectly willing to sell their ebooks at $2.99 a pop rather than $9.99 or $19.99 if it means they'll sell a lot more books, and they find that they make more money doing that way. So his argument was, I have no idea whether or not agency publishing works for these giant publishers who are involved in this DOJ lawsuit, but for small presses, for independent authors, agency pricing is the only thing that actually allows authors who are now much closer to readers than their publishing counterparts, and closer to, which has always been true. Publishers have never been close to retailers, which has always been the argument why retailers should be the ones to set prices, because they know their readers better. Now the argument is actually authors are in more direct contact, because of digital technology, because of social media, email, all of these things, authors are in more direct contact with their readers than ever before. So it's really authors who should have the final role in determining price. And in their case, since the agency model was adapting, ebook prices have actually gone down. So the trade publishers, who have a completely different model, and that's concerned with preserving both their overhead in terms of production and also making sure ebooks don't cannibalize print, they have incentives to use agency to make ebook prices go up and to hold them constant. Whereas authors, digital first authors, have a lot of incentives to play and change with pricing. And I think you could see that same dynamic playing out very well in the university press, or sort of academic scholarly press space, where university presses are much less likely to innovate in their own on pricing. University presses also don't have the kind of negotiating power the big six do to negotiate something like an agency model with Amazon. Right. Most of the small publishers weren't able to pull off what the big six were able to do. So they haven't had the opportunity to. But when scholars are self-publishing or working with smaller presses or little collectives or things like that, you see a lot more experimentation with price.
That's the aspect of it that really interests me, because I really appreciated your kind of rundown of Apple's different business models before in its store. And what has struck me, is that app developers do not have this kind of media distribution structure that TV and movies and books do. So, Apple really is an agent, basically,
yes,
for app developers. So it makes sense in a way for them to take that, very large 30% cut. Whereas, it seems weird to negotiate with publishers to do that when, again, as you say, it would have made more sense for them to buy wholesale in the way that you didn't say that, but it seems like it would have been more logical for them to treat it the way they do treat TV and movies, that these are the mediators between
the difference is the middleman.
Yeah, the middleman, exactly.
Yeah, well, I think the key thing is that there's room for digital first created books or scholarly objects, whatever it is you want to call them. They don't necessarily have to be books that are available at a huge, wide range of price points. So the idea that of a $75, ebook, and that's the only thing that anyone is going to be interested in, because it's only going to be libraries and weird scholarly interest nerds, basically an inelastic market to buy it. I don't think that really holds with digital anymore. And I think there's lots of different business models that can be introduced. You know, the really interesting thing, the really positive thing that could come of this is that this weird intermediary step where we've had DRM and we've had agency pricing, it all gets blown up. And what we start to see are, you know, once you move to DRM, anyone can build an e-reading app that can read, or once you move to DRM free, anyone can build an e-reading app. And that can include all sorts of, you know, different tools that are built in it to satisfy all sorts of different audiences, not the general tool at Amazon. Anyone can build an e-book store. And you can offer trade books and scholarly books and self-published books and all of those things. You can have little boutique digital stores popping up online. You can start to see a world of experimentation where it's not just about the battles between, you know, these six publishers and these five ebook retailers that we have. And we're talking about the relative competition as, you know, the sort of percentage distribution between them. No, we actually have a chance to create a genuinely free market, a genuinely wide open opportunity that's not bound by all of these legacies that we have, including, you know, even the sort of intermediate legacy of Amazon as being this digital disruptor and, you know, in book sales and book shipping all over the world. So it's that would be the, I mean, that's kind of the silver lining for everybody. But I don't know, that's just the way I see it.
Well, you know, for that intermediate step for Amazon, I checked while we were talking, and whoever owns Leviathan.com is not making use of that URL. So, Jeff Bezos, if you're listening, which I know you are, you might want to contact those people and go ahead and buy Leviathan.com, and it would be a much more appropriate moniker for your company eventually, given the sort of trend of your business.
Tim, explain that in a deposition.
Yeah. Sorry. Probably way more than anybody wanted to know about the DOJ lawsuit.
But see, I think that was really crucial because it is I think for the reasons that we just got into, it's a really crucial story in academia because I think that last point you made, Tim, about this being, we're kind of in a transition phase here, is going to be really important. And I think, you know, I'm glad I don't own stock in university presses because I'm not sure, not that they sell it, but I'm not sure that they're going to prosper or even survive in this transitional period because my own view is that we're going to see a lot more kind of boutique presses beginning to appear that are a response to the unwillingness of university presses to publish and the frustration that scholars have over the inability to get monographic material to a wider audience. And this is something, you know, this is an argument that's been had in academia for the last 15 years or so. And so I think, as you say, Tim, it's so much easier now to create a method for getting your words in front of other people. I think we're gonna see the university press model finally breaking down, and some of them will survive for various reasons. But I don't think in the current version. Turning to north of the border, Amanda, you noticed that some interesting things were going on with access to scholarly materials in just across the border into Canada. What was that story about?
Sure. So this is an ongoing story that just came on my radar fairly recently. Last week, the Association of Universities and Colleges in Canada, which is just sort of a, you know, one of these informal associations of that, you know, writes policies and that kind of thing for universities in Canada, has negotiated a model copyright licensing agreement with an organization called Access Copyright, which, as best as I can tell, is kind of the Canadian equivalent of the Copyright Clearance Center. Many universities in the United States use. It's basically, you know, Copyright Clearance Center is basically a service that will negotiate the rights for use to a number of, you know, scholarly articles, books, that sort of thing. It makes it much more convenient to get permission to print something in a course pack or put it in an e-reserve system, that sort of thing. It just sort of sets a price. And you pay that price, and then you know that you are legally allowed to use that that work. So what's happening in Canada is that the this Association of Universities and Colleges has said that they're going to kind of bulk license lots and lots of material for these things like e-reserve systems and course packs to the tune of $26 per full-time student per year. Now, so again, this would be an annual cost. And so basically the AUCC is like presenting this as a model for universities. No individual university is required to sign up for this, but they had a previous version of this sort of model agreement, which costs much less. And I think was done on a sort of a more, you know, it wasn't done on this model of per student per year, you know, cost. It was, you know, rougher and therefore more inefficient, but roughly more, it was like 10 cents per page for the materials. So at any rate, some people are objecting to this, and I have to say that I would be among them, in that the problem with things like this model copyright agreement, even though individual universities can choose whether or not to adopt it, the problem is that you wind up paying for a lot of stuff that you do not have to pay for, basically, because there's a lot of this stuff that could be fair use, arguably, particularly in an educational context. There is a very sort of annoying bit of language in this model copyright agreement, this model license, that defines copying as including posting a link or hyperlink to a digital copy, which certainly in the United States and in most sort of rational people's minds does not constitute copying and therefore does not require permission. So if you're, you know, paying $26, you know, per full-time student per year annually to allow, you know, teachers to post links, that seems ridiculous because you can do that for free. The same, you know, the other point is that a lot of the materials that are covered by this kind of license agreement might already be paid for by universities in the form of access to that material through databases that you can access through the library's website. That sort of thing. So it's relevant to things we've talked about earlier, such as the Georgia State University e-reserves case, which you know, has not yet been you know, an outcome has not been yet determined for that. We keep hearing that any day now they're going to decide who's at fault in that Georgia State University permissions case. But it's the kind of thing that indicates that universities and university associations might be willing to spend a ton of money just to kind of insure themselves against the risk of getting sued by publishers or whoever in the manner that GSU did get sued. But whether that cost is worth it and whether it sort of erodes fair use rights by defining this stuff as stuff you have to pay for is what's of interest here.
Well, and is it this being this $26 a student, are the universities paying this or are they passing it along to the students as a library fee?
Well, they probably would pass it along to the students. Universities would pay it, mm-hmm. but they would very likely, you know, raise tuition or, you know, stick it on your bill as a $26 per year thing. But, you know, that would be up to the individual university, I would imagine.
It seems to me that this is just a structural problem within universities, in that it's way easier for the university, this is especially true of university libraries, to pay some ridiculous sum, giant sum, to a single entity, whether it's a publisher or an information conglomerate or a copyright clearance center or whatever it is. It's just so much easier for them to give them, like, you know, here's $500,000 or here's $25,000 or whatever it is, than it is for them to, I don't know, lobby Congress or Parliament, or for them to for them to cut individual deals with individual publishers, or, you know, I mean, this is just like libraries are set up to, like, write big checks to big entities. And so this just is kind of like the easy way out for them. And they can very easily pass on the cost because there's this other stream of money coming in, which is the tuition stream, which, you know, when you're paying Canada, not quite so much, but especially in the US, like, where you're paying $50,000 to go there, you know, $50,000, $50,026. You know, it doesn't change the market.
Friends.
So, what's that, right, Mel?
So, I said, "What's $26 between friends?"
Right.
So this is I see this as in some ways, like, there are offices within university libraries that are set up to write big checks to big conglomerates, and so this is how they do things, and so they kind of do it without thinking. I mean, it's nice if you're part of that structure. You know, it would be nice to be on the receiving end of some of those big checks, but that's just the way things work, and so this does not surprise me, I guess.
Yeah, and there's a terrific article by Professor Michael Geist in a publication called The Star, which I think is a newspaper in Canada. But he pointed out that organizations like Access Copyright, I'll quote from his article here, spent 30% of its licensing revenues on administrative expenses, including over $2 million for copyright board applications and professional fees involving lobbying against copyright reform that might benefit educational institutions. That's the part that just raises my blood pressure. You know, here are universities giving lots of money for, I'm sure, as you say, Tom, just to make things easier for themselves, and it winds up, you know, going into, you know, lobbying, political lobbying against copyright reform, when, you know, we could be getting this stuff for free. We could be arguing that, you know, we have the right to use some of this stuff. You know, not all of it. I'm not saying that all work should be free, you know, or anything like that. But there is a great deal of this work that could be fair use in order to use. And there could be much clearer stipulations in both, Canadian and American law for what is and is not fair use. But no, instead, we're going to shore up the current screwed up system and pay money to institutions who have an investment in the current screwed up system.
But just to play devil's advocate on this a little bit, you know, I remember early on, decade or 15 years ago, when all this student copying started happening on the internet and across university networks, and general counsel started freaking out about the possibility that universities might be sued as complicit, that this idea was floated. And I think it was floated by people like Cory Doctorow, just in a larger sense of taking the blank tape method of indemnification. Like, let's all just pay some tax on our internet, just like we did when we bought blank tapes, because the recording industry assumed we were going to copy records with it or other tapes with it. So it was going to be used to do illegal copying. What if there was a charge of, you know, a university fee that basically said, all right, you know, we know what's what. We know students are going to just download stuff from Russian book sites and things like that, and we're just going to, you know, pony up some tax on it. I mean, it is an astonishing amount of money. I was just doing the calculation at $26 for the 31,000 students at George Mason. That's over $750,000 to every year for this. And this is not that. This is not that kind of broad insurance, because, Amanda, as you pointed out, when you look at the details, there's all these weird things about how it says it covers, like, linking to an article online. You know, I mean, that's covered. I mean, that's fair use to link to an article that's online. So, but I'm sort of intrigued by the idea that maybe there's some middle way. Again, just playing devil's advocate here, that you could sort of say, all right, universities are going to be like copyright crazy zones, and rather than, as in the Georgia State case, like, you know, suing universities or trying to figure out who's making course packs illegally, why don't we just, like, have some general charge and we'll split that money up among the various copyright holders?
I need to do some more research on this, because I don't exactly know how it works, but something along these lines happens in Europe. I know that every year or 6 months, or I don't know, every once in a while, a check comes to the Center for History and New Media in the mail for, you know, $1.76 or, you know, $10.52. Yeah, it's some, like, small change check comes in the mail from some, you know, European internet clearinghouse, you know, warehouse entity thing, and it's for... just that is that, like, the Center for History and New Media has a certain amount, you know, there's a certain threshold of traffic. And if you cross that threshold, this European agency which is collecting taxes, money from someone, sends you a check for, because, and it is for just that purpose, because like the assumption is people are stealing your content. So I need to know more about this, what this check is. We've been happily cashing them for 10 years. But there is a structure like that of some sort set up in Europe.
You know, Tom, if you're concerned about what to do about that check, I have direct deposit set up here on campus, and you know, if it's bothering you to get the money, just let me know, and I'll happily take it.
If you ever really need $1.76, you feel free to come to me directly. Happy to help you out.
In response to your comment, you know, might this not be some kind of solution? I mean, I'm thinking about it, and I remember reading that proposal by Cory Doctorow. I suppose what sort of gets my goat about it is that it's an annual tax, right? Yeah. I mean, which I guess taxes are. Right. And that it's, you know, there's no way to sort of buy the right to use any piece of content kind of in perpetuity. There's no way to, I don't know, sort of keep costs down, you know, because you're buying
you're buying a bulk license to anything that Access Copyright, the Access Copyright Center has, you know, but the problem, right, of course, is it is still a limited amount, you know. And on the flip side of this, I mean, just to take off my devil's advocate hat or horns, I guess, you know, that you just think about at a university like Mason, if you freed up $750,000 a year, you could instead have, let's say, and I think this is in fact a conversation we're supposed to have on campus next week, according to an email from the provost, but you could have a pool of money. I don't think it's going to be this large, but you could have a pool of money to support open access publishing.
Right.
So,
you know, and there's also the point, of course, that, you know, much of this content might be stuff that's authored by, say, GMU faculty,
right?
So why should you pay to get your own stuff? I mean, certainly not the majority of it wouldn't be written by your own faculty, but still, I have
no doubt that this was written up by general counsels, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is like the kind of an arrangement that lawyers really like, because it's kind of a blanket. It's a fixed cost. It's high, but it's a fixed cost. You know, there's not a lot of like further negotiations that have to go on. My understanding is that each campus can choose to accept it or not, right? It's opt-in. So I just think, you know, it's one of those things that that it is what it is. I'm sure it makes the lawyers happy. I'm sure it makes the copyright, the Access Copyright Center happy. And it'll be interesting to see what the use is.
You know, the one thing I'm a little nervous about now, given what Amanda said about linking as copying, is that if we put a link to this story that she mentioned from the Star, are we copying?
Do we have to pay for that?
I don't know.
If we have to have a budget for Digital Campus, I suggest $10,000 per year.
Okay. All right. Yeah. We'll have to set that aside. You know, at that Provost Forum, Dan, maybe you should just ask for some money for that.
I'm going to. Well, I already have, you know, as soon as it starts, I'm going to stand up and yell, Jacuzzi! I don't think that's going to be taken well by our provost.
Yeah. Well, you know, the provost, you know, they make the big bucks so that they can pay for that extra thick skin they need to wear.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No kidding.
Yeah.
So, you know, the other thing we wanted to mention just briefly today, and I think we'll have a lot more to say about this over the next couple of podcasts, and I realized that this is kind of going to break our streak of not mentioning the company whose name begins with a G, who we went through an entire podcast without saying last time. But just because we weren't talking about them, they came out with a whole new service, and that would be, of course, Google and the appearance of Google Drive, which splashed onto the internet over the last few days. Has anybody had a chance to play with Google Drive?
A bit, yes. So you know, you get 5 gigs flat out, and it's pretty inexpensive if you want to ramp that up. At this point, I've got way too many virtual drive accounts. You know, I've got SkyDrive with Microsoft. I use Dropbox pretty regularly have for years. So, you know, cloud-based storage is not that big a deal. The real issue with Google Drive, the real selling point for it, I think, are the services that they can build around it, both with, you know, backing up, giving at least some kind of offline access to things that you store in your Google Docs, syncing, which is pretty popular now. And then also there's, you know, there's a software development kit where people are building in these apps that are designed to interact with your Google Drive account. I think there's, what, 18 of them now, and a few of them at least are related, are directly tied to education or related to it in some way. So there's, you know, there's a new graphing calculator app. There's a, you know, a diagramming app. There's one e-reader app that isn't all that great. I think it's called 8Reader, but it's, you know, sort of a cloud-based e-reader app where you can upload books and read them, you know, upload your books and read them in a web browser. HelloFax, it's, you know, sort of a document thing. A lot of kind of document creation. AutoCAD, you know, sort of cloud-based version of AutoCAD to do designing things. And, you know, these are just the launch partners. So the ability to build in, you know, sort of cloud applications that interact with people's Google's documents, and you're sort of moving documents really seamlessly around in there in the same way that you would in Google Docs with these third parties is I think, potentially really important. That's more important, I think, than getting the 5 gigs of storage for free.
Yeah, I mean, the Washington Post had a story today about it, and one of the things I'm going to have to take a look at after we're done podcasting is the author said essentially Google Docs no longer exists. It just appears to exist, but in fact, you're using Google Drive when you use a Google Doc now.
Yeah. And, I think even the URL, I think, redirects now.
Yes, I mean, I opened my Google Docs app on my phone this morning, and it, I had a message saying, like, this is now Google Drive. You know, and actually, what I think it is that they're using the infrastructure that's sort of always been there for Google Docs. And Google Docs been functioning as kind of a, I don't know, a half-assed Google Drive for a long time now. So yeah, I mean, I do think the SDK is interesting. The one question I have, and this is where Google, this is where I think, you know, there's kind of a clear competition being set up with Microsoft SkyDrive, is the SDK is I mean, this is the Google way to do things, right? APIs and SDKs, and it will integrate with, you know, HelloFax and these other third party products. I think the big question for lots and lots of people is, will it integrate better with Microsoft Word, Microsoft Excel, you know, these productivity applications that really are the things that everybody still wants to use. And I think SkyDrive does and will. You know, it'll be interesting. You know, it's the closed ecosystem versus the open ecosystem. You know, same thing as always. And I think it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the launch partners is this app called Nivio, which is sort of a intermediate translator between Microsoft Office and Google Drive. It's a pay service, but what it does is allows you to open Microsoft Office files and kind of move them back and forth. Use Microsoft Office on the desktop, the sort of local client, and use a Google Drive or Google Docs up in the cloud rather than Microsoft's built-in, you know, Office Live or SkyDrive or any of those things, which I think is really interesting. This ability to kind of translate back and forth.
Yeah, I mean, the question will be, you know, do third-party syncing services like that get you the last, you know, 5% of the formatting, the spacing, the fonts? You know, it's that kind of like...
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That's how Google Docs has always been. You know, like you create something in Google Docs and you export it to Microsoft Word, which a lot of people really need. I mean, for us, oftentimes, you know, Google Docs, full stop, is fine. But when you export, it's like the format, you know, all that
niggly little things.
It's that stuff that is enough to, you know, I mean, it's enough to like just say like, you know what, screw it, I'm gonna go with the native service.
Yeah, if they could just get the footnote formatting right, then I think you would see a real migration of scholars away from Microsoft Word. But it's speaking as somebody who uses not only a lot of footnotes, but a lot of footnotes with weird diacritical marks in them, I can't do it. I've tried.
Yeah, I mean, it's not sexy, but it's like, you know, it's like, it's still what, you know, you need the fidelity. So I do think that's a question. I think it's, you know, as always, it's where Microsoft has an edge. But Google's services, it's very interesting.
I also just wonder if Google, as with a lot of their properties, we don't need to mention Google Wave, but you know, the mental like model of these things is just so much harder. Do they really explain what Google Drive is? Well, it's an evolution of Google Docs, and you know, and it's sort of everywhere, and it's got, you know, I don't, for regular people, I mean, Dropbox is the only cloud service that like normal people understand. It's a folder, you put something in it, and that folder is on your iPad too, and you go there, and it's like there.
I know two people over 80 who installed Dropbox in the last couple of weeks and said, wow, this works great.
Yeah, so. But you know, like mentally, it's like that metaphor, it works great. But these other services were like, even Apple's iCloud, I just can't explain it to people, you know? Like, well, yeah, it's sort of like that, but you know, there's no file system, you know?
Yeah, Google Drive, you know, it's got a file system too. Some of it is a little bit odd. Where again, you've got, you know, some of the files, some of the sort of phony files. So when you install Google Drive, it puts a little folder on your computer, and it syncs back and forth between those two. And things that you drag into the folder will sync up to it. And even if you install some third-party apps, so I did this with HelloFax actually this morning. You know, it'll put a little HelloFax folder on your desktop, and it'll store all those things that you're doing in HelloFax in the cloud. It'll come back and sync them up locally with files and folders. So there's a weird it's almost half in both worlds. It's half in this weird Google Cloud. We don't need files anymore. We could just do search and tags for everything, and trying to live still in this desktop files and folders metaphor that has proven really resilient, you know, particularly on, you know, anything that has a keyboard on it. And anything, you know, that desktop metaphor is really powerful. So I think, it's one of those things where it's trying to go a little bit in between the two of them. Not sure. Again, it's not as immediately intuitive. It doesn't have the kind of deep file integration the way that Dropbox does. You know, even some of my little tips and tricks to get Dropbox to sync things that are not in the Dropbox folder, they don't work in Google Drive, which is a big downer for me. But I don't know. There's a little bit more of that there, I think, than you think.
Yeah, and then, I mean, the other thing actually, Dropbox. This is a kind of a related story they've introduced recently, which is just again like dead simple and incredibly useful, is that every document you put in your Dropbox folder now has a URL.
Yep.
Right? It's just like, you could just share that URL with anybody.
Yeah. That used to be the one thing that was a pain. You had to put it in your public folder and then make the link and send it to people. Yeah.
Oh, right now, amazing. It's just like, yeah. And so like now, if you ever want to share a document with the world, you just like send them to this URL that every document has. And, and that makes sense to people too. It's like, oh, I just go here and I get the document.
So, you know, when I read Jaron Lanier's You Are Not a Gadget, he had a whole bit in there where he was lamenting the invention of the file, basically, and the file folder system. You know, he said it was oppressive and unimaginative. And I remember reading that and thinking, I don't know, man. I think that was kind of, it feels inevitable. I mean, you know, maybe that's just because it's so familiar, but I think we think in terms of objects, and we've been trained to think of files as objects and, you know, to organize them in folders that also look like objects, you know, and it's hard to imagine any other way of managing things.
Yeah. I mean, really, kind of what we need are, so, you know, I do this thing. There's this little trick you could do on the Mac. There's a similar one on Windows where you could create a symbolic link to a file, and it exists in Dropbox, and so you create a symbolic link to, you know, your file in your documents folder, whatever it is. You then, you know, do that. You put the symbolic link in Dropbox, so it's like a shortcut that doesn't know it's a shortcut. So kind of like in Blade Runner, like the replicant that doesn't know it's a replicant. and it's perfect because you get visually at the level of the interface, you get that file and folder model. But then at the level of storage and all of those things, you get all the same things you get with cloud, where things are just allowed to exist in more than one place. And you're allowed to access them through all sorts of different routes. You're able to search them all over. I think that's the idea is, I think ultimately files and folders might not be the greatest way to do a computer file system in terms of storage, because you get all these redundancies and kind of clunky things happening. But as a user interface, it's really super powerful. And I don't know, again, we're all kind of office-y knowledge workers, so it feels intuitive to us. It's, some people, maybe it's less intuitive. But it's one of those things that people have always tried to kind of move away from it or put a different skin on it or try to do something that's better, and it just keeps popping up over and over again. You can't kill it.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for that, because it's been really great having you on the podcast, and I think you're absolutely right in what you just said, that, you know, again, it's the sort of intermediate phase that we're in that you were describing earlier about the publishing industry. There's a lot – we're just in this zone where people are still trying to figure it out. I do wonder why Google didn't just buy Dropbox and call it Google Box, but
a lot of people tried to buy Dropbox. Apple tried to buy Dropbox. Dropbox has some legs to it. There's a lot more you can do with files and syncing. They want to be a big company,
yeah,
and they're one to watch.
Well, that should be, because as we've all said, it just works.
Yeah.
For our regular listeners, just to remind you, we've been so happy to have Tim Carmody, who's a senior writer at Wired Magazine, with us today.
And Tim, senior writer at Wired, Wired.com.
Wired.com. So thanks, Tim. I really appreciate you being on. All of us do. And it's been great having you. And that does it for today. And we'll look forward to seeing you, all of your listeners anyway, on our next edition of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do.